Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I always say, don't hate on Velveeta for being Velveeta. It's more of a reflection of our food system than it's the problem itself.
Gordon Edgar, cheesemonger, author, and cheese fanatic. Yes, he even likes Velveeta. He gives us a brief history of cheddar in America. Harvest Public Media covers agriculture issues in the Midwest, but they haven't had much to talk about leading up to the Iowa caucuses because the candidates just aren't talking about food production on the stump. Then elderly gardeners find workarounds to make growing food easy on aging bodies. Farmers in the Great Plains are incentivized to convert their land back to prairie, and a flourless chocolate torte, a nice treat with Chef Bob Atkins. What's up in the world of food news? Here's Mark Chilla.
We used to have more fish than we thought, and that means we're harvesting about 50% more than official global figures show. Sweeping research published in the journal Nature Communications compared data from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization with data from so-called hidden sources like fish markets, consumer surveys, and hotel invoices. The study collected information from 200 studies and a network of 400 people in countries around the world who dug up ways to measure unreported catch. FAO data shows that global catches peaked in 1996 with 86 million metric tons and have slowly declined. The new study puts the global 1996 fish harvest at 130 metric tons. That means the drop is much steeper and more worrying than official numbers suggest. Researchers said there is one silver lining buried in the numbers. With sustainable practices, world fish stocks could bounce back to higher levels than thought before. A new genetically modified apple designed to resist browning may be hitting shelves soon. The Arctic Fuji apple would follow in the footsteps of the Arctic Golden and Arctic Granny apples that were approved by the USDA last February for commercial sale. Okanagan Specialty Fruits, or OSF, petitioned the USDA in December for its Fuji variety. The apples brown less by what OSF calls gene silencing. The Center for Food Safety has opposed the genetically modified apples, saying that by removing the browning function, people are less able to decide when the apples are no longer fresh. And a story about a fast food company that brags about doing the fast food thing better than its competitors. Its secret? The workers. Pal's Sutton Service has 26 locations across Tennessee and Virginia. It's four times faster than the second fastest restaurant of its kind in the nation, and 10 times more accurate. The recipe is simple. A real human takes your order and translates it to the crew. The restaurant chain credits extensive screening of applicants and serious coaching for their success. Employees must receive 120 hours of training before working on their own. Just a short update this week. You can read more in-depth articles on our website, eartheats.org.
Great. Till next week, Mark.
See you then.
As the Iowa caucuses approach, candidates are still actively wooing voters in a state that relies on agriculture for about a third of its economy. But even among cornfields and iconic grain silos, food and farming policy isn't getting a whole lot of attention. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer asks, if school lunches and the environment and farm supports don't come up in Iowa, will they matter at all in the 2016 presidential race?
Let's get something out of the way right off the bat. There is one ag issue all politicians talk about in Iowa. Ethanol.
We've been very pleased with how attentive the candidates have been to Iowa's farmers, and it's exciting and I think shows the strength of the issue.
That's Derek Eden from the lobbying group America's Renewable Future. It gave only Ted Cruz and Rand Paul bad ratings on support for the Renewable Fuel Standard, a federal law that props up the ethanol industry. But even though most candidates express support for ethanol, that doesn't necessarily mean they're paying attention to any other concerns farmers have. Because there's a lot more to our food system than renewable fuels.
The agricultural issues are probably going to be the deciding factor in most caucuses for me.
Central Iowa farmer Aaron Lehman wants to hear candidates' views on the farm safety net, trade, and conservation. But that's not what candidates are talking about for the national TV cameras.
Agricultural issues aren't automatically going to bubble to the top, even here in Iowa.
So Lehman asks candidates and campaigns directly, something Iowans are uniquely poised to do. Some say a specific ag agenda isn't necessary because farms aren't so different from other businesses. Here's Kirk Leeds, CEO of the Iowa Soybean Association.
We need fair access to markets. We need a stable economy. We need to deal with currency issues and currency manipulations.
His list goes on, and he says it's the same as almost any business interest would make. Still, when Leeds threw his personal support behind Marco Rubio, the Florida senator's campaign included him on a list of endorsements from agricultural leaders. Iowa State University political scientist Max Shelley says candidates have to balance local appeal and modern concerns with an agenda that will resonate nationwide. So on the trail, the closest many candidates get to our food system is...
You have candidates showing up at the state fair. Sometimes they go to pig races and they hang around on hay bales and farms. And not that that's necessarily typical of Iowa, but to attract support within the state, you kind of have to start there and build out from that point.
Ethanol becomes a natural fit because it links early voting Iowa with Corn Belt neighbors like Illinois and Nebraska. Shelley says that regional reach is in the job description for the first four state contests, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada.
They're in some sense meant to be representative like the Midwest or the Northeast or the Southeast or the, well, West.
Where are food system issues such as GMO labeling, school nutrition, and antibiotic resistance? They all fall under the Federal Agriculture Department at some level. If candidates aren't talking about them in Iowa, it's possible they'll be left out of the campaigns entirely.
Now introduce the next president of the United States, Hillary Clinton.
At a recent campaign stop in Ames, Hillary Clinton's nod to agriculture was, predictably, a mention of Iowa's leadership on renewable fuels. And this passing reference.
That every single child, whether you're the granddaughter of a factory worker or a farmer or a grandson of a trucker or a teacher, you will have the opportunity to go as far as your hard work, your talent will take you.
The speech could have worked anywhere, even with the farmer mention. Voters in the audience talked about agriculture only when specifically asked about it.
It's pretty far down on the priority list.
I am interested in ag issues, but I haven't heard a lot on the campaign trail about ag issues.
I should say something because I live in Iowa, but no.
Iowa farmers have done what they can for almost a year to convince candidates to care about agriculture. Whether their efforts will be reflected in the campaigns after caucus night may depend on how long the nominating process takes and whether an ag-heavy state ultimately tips someone from candidate to nominee. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
This story is posted at harvestpublicmedia.org. Later on, several environmental groups are working in the Midwest to turn back time by converting farmland back into prairie. Gordon Edgar spends his days slinging cheese at the Rainbow Grocery Cooperative in San Francisco. One thing he's noticed from customers over his 20-plus years as a cheesemonger...
You know, when they started getting into fancy cheeses, they didn't want to talk about cheddar. It was almost like beneath them.
Because to American consumers, cheddar also means Kraft Singles and Velveeta. But cheddar started on the farm. Small scale, made from milk from your personal herd of cows. In his new book, Edgar tracks the path of cheddar from the farm to the factory. His story starts in the mid-1800s on the American farm. Back then, cheesemaking was a way of extending the life of milk.
With cheddar, you're taking, the curds that you create. You know, you add rennet, you get curds and whey, separate out the whey. And those curds, you just keep cutting them down, heating them up, stacking them on top of each other so that you get the most moisture out as possible. And that's what makes the cheese last a long time.
That stacking of the curds, that's called cheddaring. Then press it into cylindrical forms, wrap it in cheesecloth, and seal it with lard. Then comes the naturally occurring mold and bacteria as the cheese ages. Edgar says during this process, a lot of things can go wrong.
If you read the old, you know, scientific magazines and newsletters and things like that, you know, there's a lot of talk about cheeses just blowing up. There's a lot of talk about, you know, getting maggots in your cheese. There's a lot of talk about, you know, rinds cracking and cheese being inedible. And a lot of the technical aspects of cheddar making, which came in mostly the 1850s through the late 1800s, you know, were about fixing those problems and making it so you could make a really aged cheese.
An Englishman, Joseph Harding, standardized cheese making. He developed a tool to mill the curds, and he also stressed safety. His method made its way across the Atlantic, where cheese factories in America in the early 1900s prided themselves on safety and homogeneity. They produced rindless cheddars that were coated in wax. Then Joseph Kraft came along and took the Swiss method of processing cheese, and he ran with it. You take a cheddar, heated and emulsified, and form it into a homogeneous plastic mass. That's one branch of the cheese family tree. A different branch is made up of companies like Tillamook. They've been making cheese in Oregon since the mid-1800s. These days, their factories produce 14 different types of cheddars that have been aged for different amounts of time. Total daily output, 167,000 pounds of cheese. Factory-produced cheese like this basically all starts with the same recipe, says Edgar, and it's the same recipe that cheesemakers have used for generations. He says the difference is in the execution.
I think a great way to look at this is there's a cheddar that is made by Cabot that is aged at the cellars of Jasper Hill, and it's a cloth-bound cheddar, which means it's traditionally made. It gets aged in cheesecloth, larded, rotated. You know, it's a cheese that can't age as long as a cheddar that's aged in plastic, but has much more character and flavor. And the ones that they make under the Jasper Hill aging name come from one specific farm. Like, that milk comes from one specific herd of cows. So it has a very distinctive taste. Now, Cabot also makes, pretty much using the exact same recipe, makes another cheese that they call Lamberton that uses basically whatever milk that they have, you know, that day. The other difference is that it's not a traditional cheddar. It's aged in plastic. It doesn't have a rind. But often when I'm doing cheese events, I'll bring both those cheeses together and have people taste them. And it's amazing what difference you can taste.
Edgar does a lot of tasting in his line of work. He tends to focus on the Cabots and the Tillamooks of the world. But most co-ops like his offer a type of cheese that's more suited to the Kraft branch of the cheddar family tree.
In the past, you know, the vegan cheeses were always just kind of copying Kraft singles, basically. They were trying to make a plasticized, you know, emulsified, processed, fake cheese, basically. And so, you know, you had the results you'd expect with that, which is that it didn't taste very good, you know. But now people are actually making something that has integrity as food. I mean, basically, people are taking nuts, they're taking cashews usually, and fermenting them and actually doing something cheese-like with them, which is fermentation. But I think it's a mistake to call it cheese.
Whatever you want to call it, it's fairly easy to make at home. We've got several vegan fake cheese recipes on our website. On the other hand, he's spoken with folks who have tried and failed at making cheddar in their kitchens. So the word is, leave the cheddar to the professionals. Gordon Edgar's new book is Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. His website is gordonzola.net. That's Gordon, his first name, and Z-O-L-A. Coming up with gardener Gene Bruce.
It's just part of your life. I mean, it's good for your soul. I guess that's one way of saying it. It's good for your soul.
And we'll hear about ways to make growing food less hard on the body. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. and Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back. I'm Annie Corrigan. We don't often cook desserts on Earth Eats, but when we do, they are incredible. This one is restaurant quality, and once you see how easy it is to make, you might never rely on the pros again. It's a flourless chocolate torte. Bob Adkins is by the stove for this recipe. He says if you've made a ganache before, this'll sound familiar.
Okay, so I'm going to jump right in because my cream is already hot. So to that, about 4 cups of semi-sweet chocolate chips. Add about half of them. Get them to melt down. To that, we're going to keep packing on the calories. I would love to see the calorie count on this. This is a half pound of cubed butter. Going to whisk that in. You notice this is all off the heat. All I did was heat the cream, brought it up to one boil. There's enough heat in that cream to keep, because you don't want the fat to separate, because there's a lot of fat in the chocolate and in the butter. So that's set off to the side. So I've got 8 eggs. These are all at room temperature as well. A cup and a half of sugar. Just going to beat this all together so it starts to get a little pale in color. It's also going to incorporate some air into it. Lastly, a pinch of salt. Now we're going to temper our egg mix with our ganache mix. So we're going to add about 1/4 of the hot chocolate ganache. I didn't add it all at once in case the ganache was too hot. It might scramble your eggs. At this point, you could also add other flavoring ingredients. You could add some bourbon and make this into a bourbon chocolate torte. Some orange zest or orange juice. Cayenne pepper would do nice in there. It's kind of a new thing you see in chocolates. We're just going to bring this all together so it's nice and incorporated. So at that point, that is your batter. It looks a lot like a brownie mix or something like that. You could use any size cake pan. But what I have done is I've lined this with parchment paper, cut a circle out. We're going to add the chocolate just about 1/3 of the way up the pan. Those eggs, when they cook, they're going to rise, and so this will end up rising up. And also, you don't want it to bake too long. So this is going to go into a 325 oven, and it's going to take about 30 to 45 minutes. So while I just throw this in the oven real quick.
Once the timer buzzed, Chef Bob put the torte in the fridge to cool it down. Keep it in the pan so it can hold its shape. We'll do the reveal at the end of the show. Before the Midwest was a patchwork of corn and soybean fields, it was a sea of grass. Today, just 1% of the native grasslands remain, but some conservationists want to bring the prairie back to protect wildlife and preserve the soil. Brian Seiferlein of Harvest Public Media visits a project working to restore a tall grass prairie.
It's the middle of winter, but Mike Bullerman and his crew are getting ready for planting season. Bullerman is an ecologist with the Prairie Plains Resource Institute, a Nebraska nonprofit that restores and researches prairie land. Today, he and his crew are planting a Nebraska cornfield back to prairie.
These restorations, these plantings, can serve multiple purposes. They can be grazed, they can be hayed, they serve wildlife habitat needs, they filter water.
The job starts in a shed just outside of Aurora, where Prairie Plains keeps its seed. 250 species of grasses, milkweed, and wildflowers are stored in rows of garbage barrels. Most were harvested from within 100 miles.
We collect as many species as we can throughout a growing season, and it all needs to come from wild local populations.
A final seed mix is prepared by shovel, Bullerman and two assistants put on masks and goggles. They dump a few barrels in a circle on the floor, then heap the contents into a 6-foot pile in the center. Groups like Prairie Plains are working in the Midwest to turn back the dial of history. Homesteaders were the first to plow the prairie. Today, 99% of prairie grasslands has been developed for agriculture and other uses. But not all of what was once prairie is good to farm. Some of it's prone to wind or water erosion. The Department of Agriculture actually pays farmers to put highly erodible land back to native vegetation. It's called the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP. David Wadeen, a professor at the University of Nebraska's School of Natural Resources, says CRP worked.
CRP has been by far the largest conservation program in the history of the United States. And just millions of acres, private acres, that have been replanted in grassland.
CRP has been around for 30 years, but in recent years, economics have worked against conservation.
We've had corn prices shoot up to $7, $8 a bushel in the early 2010s. And so there was this dramatic increase in conversion of marginal land back to cropland within the last decade.
According to the Department of Agriculture, nearly 400,000 acres of land were converted to crops in 2012 alone. Wadeen says when that happens, it puts pressure on wildlife, including bees and butterflies. It also exposes more land to erosion. The prairie seed mix has been hauled 30 miles away to the cornfield where it's dumped into 1950s-era spreaders, hitched up to four-wheelers. The land is flat, but water has pooled in a few shallow areas. Bullerman from the Prairie Plains Institute says that's by design.
This piece of land has been in a traditional soybean corn rotation up until 2014. It was allowed to go fallow in 2015, and at that time they did some excavation to create some wetlands. Then after that, it was shredded and disked to prepare the seedbed for what we're doing today.
The two four-wheelers set off. Clouds of dusty seed fall to the ground. It'll be 3 to 5 years before this plot looks like a mature prairie, but Bullerman says it's worth waiting for.
These plants that we're working with are the progeny of what were here prior to settlement. Genetically, it represents what's left of Nebraska's natural history. Metaphorically, it represents the future.
For NET News and Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Seiferline.
We always include stories from this reporter collective in our program. They produce so much more for you to check out at harvestpublicmedia.org. We had a story last week about a compost heap that's doing work even during these cold and snowy days. Another story from the garden today, because planting season just can't come soon enough. This one's from Mark Chilla. Bending over to pull weeds, walking from plant to plant, gardening can be a challenge as we age. We meet a couple elderly gardeners to hear how they grow food despite some physical challenges.
Anne Robbins walks through her garden with the help of a cane. Her pace is slow, but it's measured and with purpose.
Fruit trees and flowering trees. And
her garden is not your average garden. It's more of a wildlife sanctuary, home to dozens of flowers, trees, vegetables, herbs, and shrubs, as well as creatures like birds, toads, bees, butterflies, and moths.
Insects of all sorts, but some really rare ones, like the Cercopian moth, the largest moth in North America.
When she started building this garden back in 2009, she spent about 2 hours a day working on it. Today, partly because of her limited mobility, it's more like 2 hours a week.
This is a low-maintenance garden, and all you have to do is cut off the dead...
As a former biologist, zoologist really, Anne is very knowledgeable, and she takes her love and knowledge of wildlife to the gardening program at the Endright Center, part of Indiana's Area 10 Agency on Aging.
When we were trying to get people to come to the classes, a lot of older people told me, oh, you know, I'd love to do that. I used to garden, but I just can't do it anymore.
That was Laura Cray. She's the nutrition program manager for Area 10 and runs the gardening program at the Endright Center.
So that just kind of got me thinking, I wonder if there's a way that older people could continue to garden.
Gardening as you get older can be a challenge. There's the issue of mobility, not to mention the constant bending over one has to do to tend to one's garden. To help address some of these issues, Cray has introduced some new things, like looser soil for easy weeding and very tall raised planting beds.
And the idea is that it just brings everything up off of the ground, making it easier for people. They don't have to stoop as low, or if you're in a wheelchair, you can just kind of reach over and your garden's right there. It makes it really easy.
It's a lot of fun. I enjoy it even still, even though it's hard on us now. I'm 70, be 76.
Jean Bruce is also a member of the gardening program. Her beans are her specialty.
It's just part of your life. I mean, it's good for your soul. I guess that's one way of saying it. It's good for your soul.
As Jean has gotten older, she has had to adapt her gardening technique. She has knee problems and is getting a knee replacement surgery soon. So that means she has trouble tending to her beans. She's come up with a solution, though. Grow her beans along a pole.
When they grow, then all you got to do is just reach up there and get them instead of getting down and trying to pick the bush beans. That's a little harder for us.
Addressing the challenges of aging in gardening requires careful planning. For Jean, it meant constructing those poles before the growing season. For Anne and her wildlife sanctuary, it's been designed from the beginning to weather any challenges.
Moths and butterflies that this
her low-maintenance garden is more or less self-sustaining. The diversity of plant and animal life means it's kind of like its own ecosystem. This is crucial because Anne, like Jean, is getting knee surgery soon.
I have to stay out of the garden for about a month because there's danger of infection. I need to get it okay.
But since she's designed her garden to take care of itself, that means it will be there waiting for her when she's recovered. For Earth Eats, I'm Mark Chilla.
This story originally aired in August. You can bask in the beauty of Anne's lush wildlife sanctuary. A photo is at eartheats.org. Once more, in the kitchen, what started as cream, sugar, chocolate, eggs, butter, and salt is now ready to be served as dessert.
Okay, so this has been chilled in the refrigerator for about 4 to 6 hours. Just gonna work a knife, something around the edge. Watch your digits. And then, hopefully, it turns right out like so. There we go. You can see all that nice, wonderfully decadent treat. And we just dress it up with some fresh berries. And so there's a nice, simple, flourless chocolate torte.
We've got a video of Chef Bob Atkins making this dessert. You can watch him in action as you follow the recipe. EarthEats.org. Bob and Daniel Orr make the recipes we share every week on Earth Eats. Liz Leslie and Chad Bouchard write our news stories. And it's Betsy Shepherd, Mark Chilla, and Aabon Binder at WFIU helping the cause. Thanks, everyone. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. All right, till next time, I'm Annie Corrigan.